Okay, everyone, I think we're going to get started soon, so if everybody can grab their seats, that would be wonderful. Okay, welcome, everyone. Thank you. Hope you've been having a fabulous day today. Let's get started. So my name is Andrea Conrad, and I'm the Director of Brand and Communications for online retailer Zulily. And today, I will be your MC for this breakout session, Innovation Quotient, Making Your Mighty Idea a Reality. And I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. This is my fourth year here at the PA Conference for Women, and it's been incredibly inspiring. I've shed a few tears. I always promise myself every year I won't. But, you know, Curate Retail Group has been here for many years, since 2013, actually. And we've always driven programming to support the advancement, of women leaders and across the state and, of course, among the community and at large. But if you don't know the Curate Retail Group, it consists of eight leading brands, so QVC, HSN, and Zulily. So a quick show of hands, how many people have actually shopped one of our brands? Oh, yay. That's awesome. For those of you who have and for those of you who haven't, there's something that is really unique to what we do. And part of that is thinking about how we focus on female entrepreneurship and empowerment. So if you have time today, please stop by our booth, the Curate Retail booth. We have some incredible female entrepreneurs and their stories and their brands, but then also have a fun photo interactive station in addition to lots of gift cards and giveaways by the hour. So please stop by. For years, we've focused on cultivating a workplace that enables professional experiences and creates an environment to foster relationships where women can thrive. And for our customers, we bring these inspirational entrepreneurial stories to life each and every day, and it's fundamentally changed the shopping experience. So without much further ado, we have an amazing hour in store for you, and I am really excited to introduce Natalie Molina Nino. She's a technologist and coder by training. She created a tech startup at the tender age of 20. Who does that? She is the CEO and founder of Brava Investments. She's the co-founder of Entrepreneurs at Athena, which is at the Athena Center for Leadership Studies of Barnard College at Columbia University. She most recently stepped into the role as CRO of PowerToFly.com and recently led the campaign for New York Times bestseller company and company Self-Made. Please welcome Natalie Molina Nino.
Thank you. We should just do the catwalk. We may as well. I'm joined by some amazing panelists. I'm so excited to be here. I had to cut in front of a line of women waiting at the men's restroom to get here. So the fact that there was women in the men's restroom and that there was a line and that they were all kind enough to let me cut just shows you what an amazing vibe we have here. So thank you. How about Serena? My publicist, I don't think she's in here, is also Serena's publicist for her fashion line. So I never get tired of hearing everything that she's working on and all about her. And so the one thing that is the latest on my side is I did publish a book by the name of Leapfrog, which we will talk about. Thank you. Yay, somebody's got it. I'm the CEO of a company by the name of Brava Investments. We are in the business of investing in businesses that can prove to us that they're making a massive, measurable economic impact on women. And so that is what I'm in the business of doing. In my career, I have been both an entrepreneur and intrapreneur, and now a newly minted full-time investor. And so I think the wisdom of the amazing planners here made it so that we have all of those lenses covered. We have an investor in the form of Gala, we have an entrepreneur from one of the biggest pharmaceuticals in the world, and then we have a local entrepreneur. And so rather than butcher their bios, if you don't mind, would you mind telling us who you are? And remember, if you don't brag, I will intercept.
Did warn us about that.
Have your bios in front of me just in case.
I guess I'll start. So I'm Morgan Berman, and I'm the founder of Milk Crate. We're a tech company here in Philadelphia, And I started this company 5 years ago when I was young enough to then get recognized by Forbes Under 30 at the pitch competition when they first held it here in Philadelphia. No longer in that demographic, but it's been an amazing journey. And I've been building this company now with an ever-evolving team of people who are all passionate about impact. Our specific focus is helping mission-driven organizations use technology to grow, engage, track, and monetize their audience. The core thing that we do is we've built a really revolutionary platform that makes it so that any organization can have a native app for their organization that's their brand without having to spend $500,000 in 3 years in development. We make it affordable and fast for nonprofits like the Committee of 70 to launch the WeVote app this week, right in time for election season. A few weeks ago, we launched an app for the largest Hispanic cultural organization in the area. And in a couple months, we're going to be launching an app for the Read by Fourth program by the Free Library here in Philadelphia to get all children reading by the fourth grade on grade level. So we have a wide impact on a lot of different causes, but we're doing it through technology that engages, tracks, and eventually, hopefully, monetizes the audience so that organizations can generate revenue through their user data instead of having to pay giant social media companies to try and reach the audience they've worked so hard to build. I came through this actually from the women's nonprofit, women's health nonprofit space. I worked at Planned Parenthood and the Maternity Care Coalition and a number of other nonprofits in the area. My background was in women's studies and anthropology. And the difference I wanted to make in the world was through women's health, but then I found technology and I always wanted to use design, and I found a way to combine all that in my business. In order to survive my business, I've also been training in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for over two years now. It takes near-death experiences three times a week to survive the near-death experience that is being an entrepreneur. Got a stripe the other night, so that was pretty exciting. And the sense of starting, thank you. The sense of starting as a white belt is very similar to the feeling of starting as a first-time entrepreneur in your 20s. So it's been really cathartic for me, and I encourage everyone to find something like that to help balance out the craziness that is the rest of our lives. So that's me.
That was even more than what was in the bio. Nice job. Just a couple things, awards from UN Foundation, White House, a few other things.
Yes. All slackers here.
Susie, tell us about you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sally Sussman.
Sally, Jesus.
No problem.
And
I am the Executive Vice President for Corporate Affairs at Pfizer. And I'm just absolutely thrilled to be here and feel the energy and excitement in this hall and to share this hour with people that I've already come to admire in the short amount of time we've been getting to know each other. When I was a little girl, I think like most little girls, I wanted to make a positive difference in the world. And so I started my career in politics and in government. And I quickly became frustrated by the bureaucracy and the slow pace of change when working in government. So I decided to make my career in business. I've worked for three great companies, American Express, Estee Lauder, and now 11 years at Pfizer. And the reason I did that is because I had a belief or a thought, an idea, that you might be able to get more done and create more change and innovate inside a well-resourced, forward-leaning, very public company. And that's what the journey I've been on and what I've tried to pursue. It's particularly gratifying to innovate at a company that is essentially an innovation company. In biopharmaceuticals, we spend $8 billion a year trying to discover new treatments and cures for some of the world's worst diseases. It's very purpose-driven work, and it's really exciting. And then in the department I lead, which is corporate affairs, and I'm grateful that lots of my Pfizer colleagues and corporate affairs colleagues have come here today, we try to innovate in the work that we do, too, to try to do things differently inside a big company. And if it's okay, I'd like to take just 1 minute to give one example of an innovation that we did in my department. I'm just wondering if anybody here has seen the movie The Intern. Can I have a show of hands? Okay. So I was flying home from a business trip, and I watched the movie. And I might have had a glass of wine or two.
As is usually the case with all innovation.
Is that right? Okay, I didn't know that. Innovation starts with a glass of wine.
Got some sober people going, no, Natalie.
And as a businesswoman, I related to the main character and her desire to have an older, wiser voice, someone who could be a friend and a confidant in the company. And halfway through the movie, I was already crying before it was over. And when I landed, I decided I was going to do this at Pfizer, that I would have a 70-year-old summer intern, and that I would try this experiment, and, you know, went to HR, made my case, and we ended up doing this, having this intern. I actually brought him here with me today. So, Paul, if you would just stand up. And it was not only fun, I think it was important to experiment with ideas of what people expect a summer intern to look like or to be. And I just wanted to make this point as an example to encourage any of you who are working in big, old, conservative companies to say you can still create change and do things differently. And that's what drives me.
Thank you. And I just, because I was looking at this amazing resume, so we're talking about Sally having been at one of the three other brands that you mentioned. It was Estee Lauder, right? I mean, these are companies that are constantly having to innovate and create new products. That is what they're in the business of doing. And then before that, when you said that you were in government, you were in some high-level positions in communications, government relations, American Express, and then also, obviously, London School of Economics, Total Slacker. You're on the board of WPP. You're also involved in the International Rescue Committee, the New York Botanical Gardens, and you were formerly a trustee of the Library of Congress. All right. Just...
All right. Thank you.
Kayla.
So Sally said when she was a little girl, she wanted to do good in the world. I wanted to make money. I really did. I'm the product of, I guess, a hidden figure. My mom helped desegregate the school in Southeast Missouri, where she was the only woman and only black woman in a high school with 30 boys in all of her classes, and they didn't speak to her for the first couple of months. And my grandfather said, the Marines are going to be in Little Rock, Arkansas, but I and some of the farmers will stand outside the school. And they said, as long as no one's physically hitting you, you know, we'll be there. But she had to endure the nigger go home and the spitting and all of that. But here's a beautiful thing that happened out of that. About 4 months into it, right, no one talking to her, just, you know, the teachers as they were lecturing, the teachers would hand back the tests, and they'd be like, you know, Johnson, you know, B minus, O'Reilly, C plus, Thelma, A minus. And the guys kept hearing her grades. And about four months into it, they started asking her, like, hey, what'd you get on question number 7? What'd you get on question number 6? And that's how she started to make friends, was because they saw her intelligence. She then went on to work on the F-15 fighter pilot. Or the fighter plane, and we moved out to Silicon Valley. So I'm a product of a hidden figure, and I grew up in Silicon Valley. And I spent 17 years in high tech, and then 17 years on Wall Street in financial services. And part of that was doing international government relations, so flying around the country during the Bush administration, trying to explain financial policy to ministers of finance in Paris and Tokyo, and I've been in about 80 plus some countries professionally, personally, and lived in many others. But this one thing kept coming back to me, which was the hiddenness of women even today. So I started right in the 60s, right, my story, 50s, 60s. 2016, I'm still seeing that we're hidden figures, and so I saw friends that were entrepreneurs and startups, and they weren't getting the capital they needed to really grow their business. And I just know that the next Snapchat, Uber, Facebook, SurveyMonkey is in the population of women that have been walking through these halls. And so I went to my husband, petite Irish guy from Dublin, heavy accent. Been with a crazy black woman for 25 years, so I'm sure he's used to it. But I said, I'm quitting my job. And he was like, what? Well, no, I say it like that. He was like, fucking what? my bad. Irish, 25 years, I still haven't mastered a Dublin accent. But and he says, what do I do? How do I support the cause? And I said, don't leave your job. We need someone to pay this New York City co-op mortgage, so keep your job. So I left, and I've started a company that, one, tells the story of women so that now it's not just a college dropout white guy in a hoodie that's our visual, but it can be a Dominican, it can be a Cuban, it can be a Haitian woman who's doing blockchain, crypto, AI, virtual reality, because that's what I see in my world, right? And so it's telling those stories, and it's getting people to sign a pledge called intentmanifesto.com. You guys can sign the pledge.
And then the other intentmanifesto.com?
Intentmanifesto.com. Yep, we got to be intentional. So Intent Manifesto. So one, we're telling the stories. We're getting people to sign up and say that they agree with us. And the other is we're just getting some money into the hands of bleep effing women so they can grow their companies.
So we're meant to talk about innovation, and from the perspective of three people that are doing it within the channels and the world that they live in, but I want to level set, and I want to level set rooted in what you already know, and I think that this room already knows, but I think that oftentimes when you're asked to have a conversation about innovation, there's this sort of presumption that either the people in the room need to be told how to innovate and the people up on the stage know how to innovate and we're sort of passing on the knowledge. But what we know is that women are starting more businesses than men in this country. We know that 8 out of every 10 of those businesses are started by a woman of color. Entrepreneurship in its various forms, whether it's entrepreneurship within an organization or outside of it, is probably the best embodiment of what it means to be a risk taker and to go out there and do things. And the single most entrepreneurial community in this country is women, and women of color especially. So I would suggest that instead of having this be a conversation about how we innovate, we level set and just presume that what we have here is a disproportionate amount of the most innovative human beings in this country, and that we go from there. What I would love to have a conversation about instead is, with that as sort of the baseline and knowing who we have in the room here, that we talk about what really needs to be innovated on, right? Be it the capital systems, be it the social justice systems, even the growth systems, right? Because what we do know also is that despite the fact that, for example, women of color are starting more businesses than anybody else in this country, they're also the ones that do not get 2.5% of the venture capital. That number is a number that gets tossed out a lot. We went from about 5% of venture capital going to women down to about 2.5. So the numbers are actually going down rather than up. But what oftentimes people don't mention is that women of color are actually getting 0.2%. of venture capital. That 2.5 number is women broadly. And so what I would love to talk about is the fact that women-owned businesses, while they are prolific, they seem to be struggling to get over the $1 million mark, right? And then even within corporations, probably the biggest levers to create successful businesses, there's a woman in my book named Nina Vaca who this year is going to hit $1 billion in revenue. She never took a penny of outside capital. She's an Ecuadorian immigrant just like me. And she did it because corporations took a chance on her. They had supplier diversity programs, and that's how she grew her business. So my question to you, if we can start there, is what are the ways that you see and that you've actually put in place, examples would be amazing, that are really centered around growth? Not creativity per se, because again, we've got that in spades. How do we innovate on growth and breaking some of those barriers, like that $1 million revenue mark, for example? And what do you think this audience needs to hear, first and foremost, from your perspective? Can we start with you?
Well, my head was in one place where you're thinking about what needs to be innovated on.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a tech company, I can understand why growth might be the thing that comes to mind first.
But either one is good.
But where my head started to go was, you know, when I was in college, the idea of earning money, like, I didn't want to touch money. I was just allergic. I was this, like, idealistic, progressive kid who was like, I'm going to go work for nonprofits, and somehow I'll pay the rent, and that's enough. And then when I started my company, and I was actually inspired by a local innovator, Judy Wicks, who was kind of the grandmother of the farm-to-table movement, she talked about in her book that money is just an exchange of value. And if you put something out into the world, then you get a value, you get value back. And money is just kind of a tool for that transaction. And that kind of helped me start to think about money differently, and also the nonprofit world and the for-profit world differently. Mm. And so when I made Milkrate a B Corp, it was a stance that we could be profitable and we could grow and we could provide a return to investors, but we could also provide a return to society. And what we've become, what I've started to think about is, just as we grow as a social enterprise committed to a triple bottom line, our mission is to basically help nonprofits function more like a social enterprise. And how can we help, in an economic way, help grow impactful organizations? And so I've kind of been thinking about how we started as a for-profit company for impact, and how what we're trying to do is flip the model for nonprofits to help them be more impactful through making more money, and to have their impact be tied to making money. And so that's kind of like, when I think about growth and I think about innovation, it's like there's been this upswell in business as a force for good in the world. Yeah. But I realized that when I started out on that path, I was only thinking about nonprofits, and then I was only thinking about business, and now I'm trying to think about how they can work together. So that's something that I'm really excited about, that I think is pretty innovative, and that I think, you know, I see more and more organizations like B Lab and Conscious Capitalism taking on, and that you can actually be more profitable, and that your business can be more profitable if you think about impact, because it will resonate with your consumers, it'll resonate with investors, and it'll resonate with your staff. And if you're adding something more valuable out into the world, your company will hit that $1 million mark. Mm. So I guess maybe I did get back to the growth thing, but yeah. It's about both. Yeah, those are that's how I think about growth, is impact.
The example that I often use is, how many of you know the story behind Patagonia, the brand Patagonia? Raise your hand if you have a sense of, like, who founded it, what do they stand for, do you have a feeling? What about North Face? nothing bad against North Face, but I don't know their story. I don't know how it came to be. I don't, you know. And so, all things being equal, I think that the consumer is moving in that direction. When I'm standing in a store and I'm deciding between a North Face jacket or a Patagonia jacket, where I know that 1% goes for the earth, where I know Yvon Chouinard lets his people surf, you know, like, it stands for something. And I think more and more consumers are, in fact, choosing the thing that stands for something.
And investors.
Yes. And investors. You have an actual framework.
Yes.
That I would love.
Yes, I'd love to build on that and touch on that. I thought your comments were fascinating. But I first have to correct the record of something that my friend Gayla said. While I wanted to do good, I was not against making money. Okay? It was never against making
money. See how they come over to my side eventually. I like the goody twos, but I like the money.
But I think it also echoes back onto the question you've asked and the dialogue that we're having, in that I believe increasingly corporations can be forces for good, mm-hmm. and that stories like the Patagonia story do resonate, and for good reason. And so one of the things that we're trying to do at Pfizer is to make our company more modern and more relevant and more engaged and more human. So thank you for mentioning the social framework. What happened was, over the last couple years, there's been more and more times that we've had to ask ourselves, should we get engaged in this or that public issue? Like you saw Nike do recently with Take the Knee. And honestly, our company didn't really have a way to think about it. We're a science company, we're a business, we know what our investment hurdles are, we know when we're going to, you know, go forward with a molecule or not. But did we get involved in climate change? Do we care about the women's march? These were questions we couldn't quite cope with. So our CEO, myself, and others, we created a social framework, we call it, where we ask ourselves four questions. First, is it relevant to our purpose? Second, how does it impact our key stakeholders, which can be patients, doctors, employees? Third is, what are our options for responding? It's not often a yes, no, do or don't. There are multiple ways in which a company can engage. And then fourthly, what is the price of not engaging in a social issue? So one quick example was last year there were several places around the country where there was a march for science. And our employees asked us, is the company going to support the march on science? And really, our company had no history of supporting marches. We would encourage people to vote, but we didn't get involved in marches because we thought they were political. So we turned to our framework. Is a march on science relevant to the purpose of Pfizer to discover new cures for health? Well, yes, that was. It was. Secondly, is it important to our stakeholders? Our most important stakeholder are probably the 23,000 scientists that work at Pfizer, and they would like to know that their company stands with them. What were our choices for engaging? We had lots of ideas, but the one we picked was to run a social and digital campaign in the areas where the march was happening. So as people were marching and they'd look at their Instagram or their Facebook, Snapchat, they could get little messages from Pfizer saying, have a good march, you know, great day for science. And we thought if we did nothing, we would be saying we didn't care. And I think not caring is very expensive for companies today. So, you know, I think that there is a movement within corporate America to speak up for, not for politics, but for your values. Mm. And that's crucial for growth.
Yeah, and innovation.
Yes. Yes.
Happy scientists
make good drugs.
Okay. You chose women of color as your frame. And I recently did a morning show with the launch of the book, and I intentionally waited until the end of the interview to do this, but because I knew it was going to happen. But I literally said the words black and brown women, and the person on the morning show was like, okay, thanks. And the interview is over, and goodbye. And those were the credits. It's not, even in 2018, an easy stance to take. So I guess I would ask you to answer from that lens as well.
Yeah. So my universe is women of color. And we're actually starting a fund, and it's going to be called WOC, Women of Color Star. So rock star, walk star, because we believe all women are rock stars and they need to be invested in. I chose women of color, black, brown, Asian, Muslim, Indian, transgender, because there wasn't as much of a focus, yet they're the fastest growing population in the startup space. They generated $360 billion in revenue last year. If they had been invested on par with their white male or female counterparts, they would have generated $1.1 trillion and added 4 more million jobs to the economy. I chose that space because it's the one I know, and one of the things you always learn in investing is invest in things that you know or think you know. But I'll tell you this, it's inclusive investing because the companies we look at, it's not that they are just women of color, but they have diverse teams. And we know that it takes diverse teams in order to grow really good companies. So yes, the sort of first lens that we look at is if there's a diverse team and if there's an underrepresented woman as part of that team. But for it to be a really good team, it has to be more inclusive. And I actually want to sort of answer the question that you had of the panel of, like, how do we jumpstart and how do you jumpstart your startup or your business? I'll throw two things out of you. One, and I feel like I need to trademark this. My team keeps telling me I should. I have this plus one rule. So whenever I'm mentoring someone or I'm going somewhere or I buy a table at a gala, I always try and bring a plus one, someone who would normally not either be at that meeting, be at that event. I didn't do it because I was late getting my act together to get here, but if, as part of being a speaker here, I'd been like, hey, could I invite someone? And I would find a friend who's in Philadelphia or a guy who, you know, a women's conference and invite. I would love for you guys to think about that as you're building your companies or as you're building your teams internally, this plus one notion. And I say that because too often women entrepreneurs are solopreneurs, right? They've 20 years at Pfizer, 10 years at Coca-Cola, 15 years in HR. They've got this great idea for something, or they just got back from the Caribbean and want to do a moisture butter product, right? and like F their job, I'm out of here. But what if you took all that knowledge you have in the insurance space or the HR space and you teamed up with that millennial who knows blockchain, who knows AI, who knows virtual reality, let them be your plus one, and then you go build something really effing cool, and then please call me so I can be the first one in the deal to invest in it. Right? Like, that's how we leapfrog and grow really good companies. Yeah. And what also I worry about and think about is we've got a lot of knowledge in here of women who've been in the trenches for a long time, and yet when we talk about venture capital, and I'm in that space, right, when my peers are talking about investing and startups and blockchain and crypto, what's that visual? It's that college dropout guy with the hoodie who's a millennial. We can't leave all the knowledge that's in this room that you've earned and experienced over all these years and think that that kid who's just coming out of college or maybe dropped out of college is going to create things for your body, his body, our children's bodies, our healthcare, our cybersecurity system, right? Like, so we need to take all the knowledge that's still here and do a plus one with some of these millennials. So that, I think, is how we jumpstart this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
I'll stop there.
Because I thought there was a list. I thought that was number
yeah,
one.
There was one, but I'll weave
we'll
it
save
in
it.
Later.
We'll save it.
Is that helpful? Does that resonate?
Yes. Okay. Plus ones. And something that people, and again, as the Nina Vaca example that I gave earlier, equity capital is not the only way, but we have a venture capitalist and another investor at the table, so we won't ignore that path, right? That is one path. A lot of investors, and I don't know, Gayla, if you have the same experience, but everyone that I know simply won't invest in a solo entrepreneur. So it is an impediment to growth on multiple levels. Most investors I know simply won't take a meeting if you don't have a partner. And I don't know that that's commonly understood.
Yeah.
Well, I actually had an experience with that where I was very, very early on with Milk Crate. It was just me in the beginning for about 6 months, and I didn't even really try and get investment during that time. We were so early. I was so early. There was no we. But I got advice from a couple different people that I needed a male co-founder.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I took it. Yeah, I mean, I took it in the sense that, you know, I had a wonderful person who was helping me, and I, you know, we kind of gave him that title for a while, but eventually it really felt fake and I couldn't do it anymore. Mm. And that was a really hard undoing, really painful one for everybody. And it hurt a lot of people to have to undo that. And so I don't ever want anyone to do what I did.
Mm. One plus thoughtfully.
Yes. Intentional yes. plus one. And you know, it's interesting you say that because one of the things when I knew I was ready to leave JP Morgan and become an entrepreneur and become a venture capitalist is the day I was in a meeting in JP Morgan and I felt like I couldn't bring my whole self into the meeting. Mm. And I thought, this is just going to zap my, like, spirit and mojo. And it wasn't anything that the company had done, right? It's just in that situation, I was like, I got to be places where I can bring my whole self. Mm. So you're right. If bringing on that person makes you smaller, right, doesn't feel good, doesn't feel authentic, that's not the partner for you.
I'm sorry.
And here's one thing I will say, though. I'll put it in the category of call to action, but doing so in an authentic way. I was at the United Nations for a blockchain summit. It was in the General Assembly. You've seen that room before recently with our leader speaking to the...
The comedy skit?
Yeah. And it was about blockchain. And everyone in there was male. Except probably male and not a lot of diversity. Probably a handful. And I'm one of those people, once I start getting bored, I start like counting people. So I was like, ooh, how many women? Ooh, how many like black people? Okay, now how many like Muslim? How many, you know, I just like count things, right? And the numbers were pretty small. It wasn't that many. And I was sitting there and I'm thinking, oh my God, like blockchain is coming and we're not in the rooms where it's being talked about. Now, yes, there's a lot of sexiness and buzz to blockchain, but I want to put out this call to action. Think about where you were when the internet started and how pervasive it is in your life today. Think about where you were when you heard something about an iPhone or a car phone to where you are today. That is going to be blockchain. Now, it's not going to be the sexy stuff, right, which is all the crypto stuff you hear. And so as I was sitting there, I thought to myself, oh my gosh, and this isn't an ad for blockchain, by the way, but this is an ad of how we can do things and still be authentic.
You could apply it to cannabis. You could apply it to cannabis. So many industries.
I keep getting invited to cannabis conferences and meetings. And I'm like, well, are we going to any taste testing, sampling the product? Are we just going through your presentation? Is there anything else going on here? But here's where I want you to think about the authenticity. So blockchain's going to happen, right? I challenge you. I bet the experience, knowledge you have today could be applied to blockchain. Now, do you have to go learn how to blockchain, right? Code for blockchain, right? No, but you might be at Pfizer. You might be at State Farm. You might be at Prudential. You might have your own hair care business, right? And I don't know necessarily yet what in hair care may need for blockchain, but trust me, someone's going to figure that out. And you might know the industry, they know the technology. So think about that. Is it authentic to you? Sure, it could still be authentic to you. But you may not know the technology, but you know the usage that consumers have and want to then pay for.
So
can I just add one thing onto what you're saying, or build on your example of, I think people who are starting their own thing have an opportunity to create a culture that is fully inclusive. What's plus one, it's the plus one you want it to be, and that's enormously exciting. A second call to action is for those of us who work in places where the culture already exists, that it creates an experience like the one you had at JP Morgan, where you felt like you couldn't bring your whole self. My guess is that was not about you.
Okay. No,
it was about the culture. And the point I want to make is that those of us who work in big companies and want to be innovative, we have an obligation and a responsibility to create an inclusive culture where people are invited, asked, required, hoped, and expected to bring their whole self, whatever their age, their color, their sexuality, their size, whatever it is. I think if big companies can't do that, they're going to lose out.
Yeah. And listen, this is not a JP Morgan bashing session, because actually, when I left, so it was just only in that one meeting, by the way, that I didn't, you know, just kind of felt icky. But what felt really good was all the work I was doing with entrepreneurs, and that, you know, sort of gave me the jet fuel to leave. About a year and a half after I left and started on this road of just, you know, talking about women entrepreneurs and how we rock and all this, J.P. Morgan called me in for a meeting, and they now are my anchor investor in the fund. And they have funded me $500,000 to just get out on the road and talk about how great women are. So
that's great.
Yeah.
And so that intent manifesto is actually fueled and started and funded by J.P. Morgan, because they're like, you're right, they shouldn't be hidden figures. So go get a gazillion signatures, go get some great stories about women out there. So that's even a corporation, even though they had great talent and walk out the door, they're still supporting that talented person in their next endeavor.
So in the time that we have left, because I want to be sure that we leave time for questions as well, we had a conversation prior to this. And we talked about what the general consensus is around where innovation comes from. And we talked about sort of some of the typical narratives. And we asked just among the four of us, and I would love to ask you, how many of you have heard the follow your bliss, follow your passion narrative, you know, and everything will magically work if you follow your bliss, right? I don't know who writes these things. Or how big their trust fund is, but the average American family does not have $5,000 in their bank account. The average woman entrepreneur, especially, or a woman leader or a woman innovator is not in a position to simply follow her bliss and things will magically come together. Some of us have mortgages to pay or can't afford mortgages. Some of us can barely make ends meet and worry every month how we're going to make it happen. And so in my book, one of the things that I talk about is forget passion, find things you want to punch. And we ended up really riffing on that idea of that the source of innovation really should be solutions to real problems. You know, if I get pitched the same tampon delivery service another time, I will shoot myself. I would love to see more solutions to non-first world problems. I would love to see solutions to problems that really keep people up at night, that are keeping people from living full lives. That's the sort of innovation that I also think we want to encourage people to embrace. And that doesn't come necessarily from only... Now, don't get me wrong, you might be really passionate about that thing that you want to punch as well. But the idea is let's find and let's build solutions to real acute problems that are going to move the dial, not just for us and our community, but for the world. And so I would love to hear your thoughts about either the concept generally, which we spent a lot of time talking about as well, but if possible, also, what is the thing, or maybe give us a couple of examples of what are those things that either prompted you and that you're now in the process of solving, that thing you wanted to punch and that's sort of the reason you are where you are, or even if you want to bring out some new ones and just to plant some seeds here in the room. But yeah, I want your reflections on that idea.
I had two very traumatic professional experiences very early on after graduating from college, working at two different nonprofits. And in a way, both had to do with resources and roles and responsibilities. But I was the funding was getting cut so badly, and the resources were dwindling that everyone on my level, all the coordinators, got kicked out, and I was the last one. So I watched all of my colleagues get fired. I watched all of the services and support that they had been delivering to that organization disappear, and I watched the rest of the staff scramble. And then I was the last one. And when I started my company, it wasn't originally to fix that problem. But as we've evolved and changed over the years, and I've actually been inspired by friends of mine who started out to solve problems they wanted to punch. I kept thinking, I want to be doing something like that. And it's been in the back of my head. And as we've grown and changed and pivoted, I've come back to wanting to help organizations reach their mission with the resources that they need, both financially and technologically, and kind of inspirationally. How do you run an impact organization in a way that will lead to the success of the mission? And
in your case, do you think it was because donors pulled out? Because you're not just giving any sort of solution. You've specifically chosen the track of produce revenue.
Yeah, right? Well, yeah, show impact and produce revenue for sure. So in the one, it was my first job out of college, and it was state funding was getting cut because some people don't want women to have access to reproductive health care. And we actually had also had a case where there was some embezzlement of some kind. I was 23, so no one told me exactly what was going on. But I think one of the problems that happens in the nonprofit world is when you don't have money to attract top talent and you don't have money to pay people properly, bad things happen, like hiring people who aren't competent or hiring people who will steal. I'm not saying that that's a widespread issue, but it's something that I saw happen firsthand. And so it has shaped my experience of that. And so... it was a combination of state funding being cut, that internal issue, and also the money coming in from the services that we provided not matching the money that was going out the door. So there wasn't a sustainable business model in place because it wasn't a business. And that's something that I've been, originally I didn't want to work for a business. I wanted to work for a place that had a mission. And then I was running a company that had a mission, and now we're a company that's helping mission-driven organizations be more like businesses. So it's been, there was that early trauma of working for these organizations that weren't operating like a business. They weren't hiring top talent. They weren't paying top market rates. They didn't have more money coming in than was going out. All of these things that are the definition of a failing organization, unless you're a nonprofit, and suddenly that's okay. Mm-hmm. But it leads to chaos and trauma and people not getting what they need. Sometimes. if you have enough of an endowment, then you can just run off, kind of like the trust fund, you can just follow your bliss and everything can be okay. But for a lot of organizations, it's really hard. So that's the problem that I'm punching in between getting, like, not punched, but strangled in jujitsu.
Sally.
I just love this notion of what do you want to punch, and thinking about how we get motivated by, you know, deep desires to fight back and not these sort of amorphous good feelings. For me, I really want to punch against the problems of healthcare in our world today. I worked at Estee Lauder, a great company that's a beloved company that makes lipstick. I went to work for a company that had a tougher role in the public sphere that makes life-saving medicine. And I really studied that and tried to understand that and have come to believe that nothing is more precious to people than their good health and the good health of their loved ones. And so trying to work to bring forward healthcare that is affordable, accessible, that is not only treatments but cures and preventions. And a friend, like a direct. Friend here, directed.
I just think
that this is a burning passion for me, for my colleagues, and a particular president who will remain nameless said recently, nobody knew healthcare was so complicated. Lots of people know healthcare is really complicated, and it's hard to deliver it. It's hard, you know, to figure out how the insurers, the doctors, the hospitals, the pharmaceutical companies can all come together to provide, to perpetuate a system that will bring the best healthcare in the world forward to Americans, but in a way in which they can reach it and afford it. And so, you know, fighting that is that, and fighting this fly, and that is just very, you know, gets me up and keeps me up at night, but gets me into work in the morning.
So I'll answer really quickly. I'm not going to use the word punch because I don't want to be the angry black girl on stage.
I'll be your anger translator.
Okay.
It's all good.
But I'm going to flip it. So two things that frustrate me is, one, this perfection paralysis that we as women often have, and that we either want to do 110%, it's got to be amazing and great before I'll show anyone, or, you know, before I think it's good enough to do.
Get three masters.
And, you know, listen, think about the internet. It's called internet 1.1 and 1.2. Like, it's called, like, I'm going to fuck up and I'm going to give you another one and you're going to buy it, right? Like, iPhone, right? So, like, let's not get stuck in paralysis. Like, put it out there. It may not have all the bells and whistles that you want, but, like, it's okay. We'll buy the next one, too, but you'll learn a lot. So that's one thing I get frustrated by for us. And then the second one is investing. This venture capital stuff, I've never been a venture capitalist. I just quit my job at J.P. Morgan and was like, I'm going to do it, right? And I'm doing it, right? It's not rocket science. And so what I get frustrated, so don't be like, I'm not going to invest in her. She doesn't know what she's doing. she said it out loud. No. The other thing I get frustrated by is investing. Ladies, women, men, our allies in the room, you're doing it every day. The same analysis that I go through in deciding companies to invest in, you're doing that same stuff when you're buying products or when you're like giving your cousin JoJo $100 because he hit you up at the family reunion and was like, I got a great idea because it's not going to fail, right? You're going through, you know, you're not going to get that money back, but you know, you went through the same thought process. So I get frustrated that we're on the sidelines. So my call to you, did I give you two? This is my second piece of homework I'm giving you. Look at that. So my call to action to you is take $100 between now and July 4th and invest in something. And just that empowerment of like, I'm an investor, hashtag I'm an investor, it is going to be so freeing and so empowering, either in terms of how you think about your own wealth and independence or how you think about starting a business. Because all the questions that you're going to think about are going to be the ones that someone's going to ask you when you start your business with your plus one.
Amazing. Thank you. We have exactly 8 minutes. We a tiny bit into your Q&A. I know your arms work. If they don't, like, just start rehearsing now. But shall we?
Yeah. First, let's give a warm round of applause for these incredible women. Thank you guys for all joining. And then I was told to issue a question, but I'd rather throw it to the audience. So if you don't mind coming to step up to the mic or shouting really loud in the 8 minutes.
Great.
I think I can shout.
Okay, perfect.
Yes.
Wonderful. much for being on the panel today. It's great information. One question that I have is we always talk about, we all have these wonderful ideas, but can you give us a little bit of an idea of from the time when you just said, I'm going to just do it, right? And so what that process looked like for you, because we often all have these ideas, but they just stay ideas. And so what happens to move that idea to an actual action?
Yeah, first thing I do is I tell 10 people. And then I say to the 10 people, I'm like, ask me about it in a month. And one of them's invariably my mom. One's someone like I really respect, someone who I know is going to follow up with me. And just A, two things happen. One, I'm accountable to 10 people. And B, I do believe that I just putting it out in the universe starts to give it some life and some energy of its own. That's the first thing I do.
I love that. There's a chapter in my book called Be a Walking Sandwich Board. People are reticent to share these ideas because they think they're going to steal your ideas. But ideas happen all the time. The only difference between the ones who succeed and don't is execution. So you don't lose anything by sharing.
I would also add, don't overthink it. Don't overstudy it. Some of the greatest things I did a little naively and maybe somewhat ignorantly. But, you know, if you need to know every bit of how it's going to work out, you'll never do it.
Yeah, don't write a business plan. Try and get one customer.
Yeah.
When was the last time you wrote a business plan?
I'm actually doing one right now because the investor is requiring it, but I didn't have one for the last, 3 years.
But it's been years. It's been years since I read one, and if someone sends me one, I just look at the table of contents to where the budget is.
Okay. I see a hand over there.
And the next person, just because we're short on time, please walk on up.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Your insights were very helpful. So I'm a woman that is stuck in trying to find a community. I come from an impoverished community, an impoverished background. I did everything that I thought I needed to do to be successful and get where I wanted to go. I was an accounting major. I wanted to make money. But then my heart went out when I went to college in the community, and I went back and people weren't doing anything. And so there's these two realities that I'm existing in where there's people who have absolutely no money and people who have money, particularly women of color, who are completely burned out. And I'm looking at these two communities and I don't know which way to go. So I guess my question is, where is the community of women who are successful and haven't been burned out yet, but wanting to do something impactful for their community, but also make money at the same time? Because I'm looking for it and I haven't found it.
Mm-hmm. There's so many.
The sustainable community, I would say, where I can visit and.
I'm sure that you guys have ideas, but people that I recommend are, you know, Pipeline Angels is an organization of successful women who want to give back, but who want to learn how to invest. And they don't necessarily, none of us. Most of us aren't born with that knowledge, and so they do a boot camp. They train these women to be good investors, and then they bring impactful businesses around them for them to collectively put little checks in to help those companies thrive. They're in Puerto Rico. They're in Raleigh, North Carolina.
New York.
They are very diverse. There's others that are like that called 37 Angels. There's Portfolia. There's CEO, where the check is $1,000, and they do debt vehicles for women all over the world. Those are just a few.
That's great. You did good.
There's also donation-based ones, like Impact or 100 Women, and there's like donation circles of women who are donating, so there's like the philanthropy side. And then also for entrepreneurs, the Alliance of Women Entrepreneurs here in Philadelphia and Forum are two groups of entrepreneurship collectives of women. And then also if you're in the B Corp world, there's like local chapters of mission-driven for-profit companies and their owners.
And the two Philly ones were Forum and?
The Alliance of Women Entrepreneurs, AWE, and Forum. Those are the two in the Philadelphia area that are for like women business owners.
And United States of Women is coming here, the Michelle Obama program from the administration. I can't remember when we're coming, but we're coming to Philly.
All right. Thank you, ladies, for your insights. So my question is going to be directed more to Sally. I'm also in drug research and development is my mainstay. And there has been a need that I identified, but my biggest fear was medical legal implications, because dealing with patients is a slippery slope. You don't want to get on the wrong side and, you know, have this big legal battle to fight. So how would you even if you don't know enough, like you don't know enough of what those medical legal implications are, you want to start the business, you want to be an entrepreneur, but the fear of having to fight those medical legal battles may keep you behind, you know, may say, okay, let me take a back step and consult, talk to a lawyer. But aside from that, something very interesting that stood out that all you women said is you did not write a business plan, or the last time you wrote a business plan, you can't remember it. So if I want to present my business plan or my idea to you as a venture capitalist, how would I go about that? If you don't want me to write a business plan, how would I come and pitch the idea to you? Aside from being innovative, impactful, and making money, what else are you looking for? How do you know that my idea is the the one that will actually be impactful, innovative, and make us money?
Yeah, I'll let you start with that.
Okay, well, first, thanks for the question, and I'm excited to know a little bit more about what your idea is. You're right, it can be daunting when there's so many legal and regulatory things that one has to work with when dealing with the sacred trust of someone's health and their bodies. What I might suggest is maybe we can grab a couple of minutes after this conversation and I could listen a little bit more to what you're doing. And I have a few friends here who will join me in the conversation who are really smart people. But it's great that you've come here and brought your idea forward. So let's chat after.
And we can do the same, but the short answer is we deal in decks. We literally deal in decks. We watch decks, look at decks, 10, 15 slide decks every day. That is the currency that we trade in, not a 50-page business plan. That's the short answer.
Yeah, but for you, the plus one's going to be really important. So you should, if the two things that you're worried about is the legal and the medical, those are the two people you need to have. That's your core team. It should be the three of you before you even get to any of us.
Our last question.
Okay, a dichotomy continues to exist. Ageism, and particularly for the females in the workforce, we are all going to age, unfortunately, but women like myself who are 68 and still functional in the workforce are often seen as the granny or the grandma type. I have a master's, a PhD, and I hide that all the time because people aren't comfortable with that. I commend you for your program, but I ask, why is he not seen as a pop-pop, yet women who age are seen as grandmoms? So that is a concept that hasn't been addressed here, ageism, in this whole conference, which concerns me, but I want to commend you for what you're doing because it's part of a way to kind of diffuse that ageism process.
Thank you. I think you raise an extraordinarily important point, and even though they have the sign up to stop, I'm going to say that I think ageism is one of the most under-discussed biases that exist in the workforce. My hair is not naturally blonde at this moment in time. Okay, but I cannot let that gray hair show if I want to keep my role in the company.
And that's just, if I could close with just one thing, facts don't seem to matter, but they need to matter more because there is actuarial data, and there is a woman who testified in front of the Senate Committee on Aging saying that women over the age of 50 are twice as likely to be successful at entrepreneurship. And if the venture capital world actually based their decisions on real facts, then all venture capital would be going to women over the age of 50.
Exactly, and that's why I said, like, your knowledge coupled with some young kid that knows the blockchain or the coding, like,
power.
But you know what? There are people who aren't comfortable working with someone my age because they just have their inherent bias. And they're always trying to fix me because if I go too slow in technology, they're always going, oh, let me help you. Like, I needed help, I would ask. But that ageism exists. Thank you.
Thank you.